Okay. We've been looking through the books of the first five books of the Bible, in that just to kind of set the broader picture. We're talking about hermeneutics, how to interpret the scriptures, and one of the most important things about interpreting the scriptures is understanding the story in terms of where we are in the storyline, as well as what has gone on in the story. I was doing some research this past week on some other things, and I was looking through some books that I had read, and several of them said something to the effect that one of the things that the Apostle Paul assumes that his readers understand and know and are familiar with is the Old Testament history. He just goes about expecting that that's something that the readers are going to know. And so I think that that's certainly important. But one of the things we'll see here as we cover, as we're now covering the book of Deuteronomy, which is the last book of the first five books there, the last book of the Pentateuch, is that we may not realize this, but the Apostle Paul, if memory serves me correctly, quotes from the book of Deuteronomy more so than any other book out of all of the books from the Old Testament that he quotes. So this ought to tell us that this is one of the key books. This is one of the key books for Paul, and it may not seem this way. So nevertheless, let's certainly give this some attention. And then one other comment, too, is remember the overall theme, and I think it's a theme that we see that is started off in the opening chapters of the Bible, and it's one that's repeated throughout the Bible, and it's this, it's that God's Son dwells in His presence, is disobedient, and then is cast into exile with the promise of restoration to the presence of God. You see that in the Garden of Eden. And now, for example, we're about to see that promise, or at least spelled out in the book of Deuteronomy. And that, remember, when the Israelites come up to the promised land, they come up to the edge of it, and they begin to make their preparations. And in fact, as we've been in the morning sermon series, the evening sermon series, talking about, going through the book of Deuteronomy, for about the last 4, 5, 6 weeks, they've been on the edge of the promised land. And what we don't realize, maybe, is that from about Numbers chapter something like 24, I think, all the way to the end of the Pentateuch, all the way to the end of the book of Deuteronomy, we're dealing with material that is preparing them to enter the promised land. So just a footnote there in terms of note the disproportionate attention given to certain aspects of the Old Testament narrative, so that the wandering, the 40-year wandering, gets barely a blink of a mention in the Old Testament in the first five books. Barely a blink of mention. Whereas the ensuing months of preparation to enter the Promised Land get like a whole book and, a book in a third or so of attention. So, in other words, there are some key events going on here. And once again, in terms of the broader narrative, we see, I think, themes here that are reminiscent of the opening chapters of the Bible in Genesis 1 through 3. And that as Israel is brought to the edge of the promised land, they're told, here are the blessings. If you obey, this is what will happen. But here are the curses. If you disobey, this is what's going to happen. So notice this in terms of these broad themes. You have Israel, who God calls His firstborn son. Okay, Israel, who is called His firstborn son, who will be placed in this land flowing with milk and honey. Again, reminiscent of the garden in many of its descriptions. This firstborn son, however, is, according to Deuteronomy, stiff-necked. Stiff-necked. This firstborn son, according to Deuteronomy, is rebellious. Okay, this firstborn son, according to Deuteronomy chapter 10, is in need of a new heart. Okay, and then last but not least, we see this in Deuteronomy chapter 21, and it's perhaps a passage that many of us find problem with because it seems so, I guess in one sense, it seems so strict or overbearing, if you will, but it's where God says, for the wicked or rebellious son, the wicked and rebellious son must be stoned, must be put to death. Okay? Now, in terms of the broader narrative, notice here the broad sweep. Israel is God's wicked, rebellious, and stiff-necked son. And because he is these things, he's to be taken and put to death for his rebelliousness. And in terms of life and death in the life of the Israelite, to be cut off from the presence of God was akin to death itself. And so Israel is thrown into exile. Okay, or Israel will be thrown into exile. So notice this. And I'm going to read a couple of these passages here. But so, for example, in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 30, notice how the degree of surety with which Moses says these things to the Israelites. He says in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 30, he says, not if you're in tribulation, but when you are in tribulation, and all these things come upon you in the latter or last days, you will return to the Lord your God and obey his voice. So notice this, that Moses, as he's saying these things to Israel, anticipates that Israel's going to be disobedient. They're going to be scattered among the nations, but then they will be obedient. They will return. If you want, you can turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 30. Deuteronomy chapter 30. And in Deuteronomy chapter 30, I want us to look at verses 1 through 6. Okay? And once again, we see Moses talking about this pattern of exile for disobedience and return from exile. And when, notice not if, but when all these things come upon you, and the blessing and the curse which I've set before you, and you call them to mind among all the nations where the Lord your God has driven you, and return to the Lord your God, you and your children, and obey his voice in all that I command you today, with all your heart and with all your soul, then the Lord God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will take you, and the Lord your God will bring you into the land that your fathers possessed, that you may possess it. And he will make you more prosperous and numerous than your fathers. And the Lord your God will circumcise your heart and the heart of your offspring, so that you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, that you may live. Now notice here, once again, Israel is cast. Again, you certainly see this pattern here in Deuteronomy 30. And in many respects, again, it echoes what's gone on in the garden, is that Israel is cast into exile for disobedience. But then it says that God, essentially in his mercy, will gather them from the nations. He's going to gather them from the nations. He's going to bless them. He's going to circumcise their hearts. And remember, circumcising the heart is ultimately, removing the disobedience, removing the sin, or in other biblical imagery, it's removing the heart of stone and replacing it with the heart of flesh. So it's important we recognize this. But in going back to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 30 and following, listen to this. And I want to ask the question on the heels of this verse as to what's the reason as to why God will restore them to the land. For the Lord your God is a merciful God. He will not leave you or destroy you or forget the covenant with your fathers that he swore to them. What's the reason that he restores them to the promised land there? Covenant. Which covenant? The Mosaic covenant? The Abrahamic covenant. So remember here, notice this. Redemption comes through the Abrahamic covenant, not through the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant, the Mosaic covenant brings forward the law and accuses. It demonstrates our sinfulness. It demonstrated Israel's sinfulness. And because of the Mosaic covenant and disobedience to it, Israel is thrown into exile. But God says, no, I'm going to restore you because of my mercy, and I'm not going to forget the promise that I made to Abraham, your father. So this is beginning to play upon, that's not perhaps the best turn of phrase. This is beginning to lay out, if you will, in terms of, this is the seeds, I guess we could say this, of Paul's theology. So that when Paul begins talking about the role of the law and what purpose it serves in terms of the Mosaic covenant, when you read Galatians 2, 3, and 4, you go back and Paul is talking very much so about the events and about the theology of the book of Deuteronomy. And so I hope that we can see these connections here. In terms of Israel is cast out for his disobedience, but is restored to the land by God's mercy because of the covenant promise that he makes to Abraham. The book of Deuteronomy ends with the Song of Moses. It ends with the Song of Moses, which in Deuteronomy 32 predicts Israel's defection. It predicts Israel's defection. In other words, here they are, and this ought to tell us right here and right now, in terms of one of the patterns you see, for example, in the Left Behind theology, dispensationalism, is they said that God had plan A, but when plan A didn't work, God was forced to go to plan B, i.e. to work with the Gentiles because the Jews just weren't listening. But you read Deuteronomy 32, where Moses basically says, they haven't even entered the promised land yet. And Moses said, you guys are going to go astray. You're going to be taken away into exile. You're going to be disobedient. So God knew from the outset what was going to happen. And so we can look at it in this way. Israel was never meant to be the end goal. Israel was never meant to be the end goal. Christ was meant to be the end goal from the very outset. Think about it when Paul says in Romans 5:14, Adam, who was a type or a shadow of the one who was to come. When you see again, and we talked about this last week, where you have Israel's desert wanderings and Israel's disobedience, and Israel is God's disobedient son. So that when Christ comes and God says, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased, and he goes into the wilderness for 40 days. And by contrast, this son of God, this one true son of God, is obedient to everything that God says. And not only that, but what's curious about this is that when Christ quotes scripture to refute Satan, do you know what book he quotes? Book of Deuteronomy, three times. Okay, the book of Deuteronomy, three times. So I say all of this to say that, and you know, to repeat this again, we can't understand, in my opinion, well. We can't understand well the significance of the New Testament apart from the Old. They're so intertwined and so interconnected. Okay, so here we go. Deuteronomy 32 predicts Israel's defection. Deuteronomy 33 has a poem of blessing and restoration. And then Deuteronomy ends on a note of hope. And let me turn here to the end of Deuteronomy. Notice here, let's see here, you have blessings of the tribes that conclude with Deuteronomy chapter 33, and then let's see how 33 ends. Happy are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, the shield of your help and the sword of your triumph. Your enemy shall come fawning to you, and you shall tread upon their back. So here, notice that though it predicts Israel's defection in the previous chapter, notice how it ends on this note of hope. It ends on this note of hope. And then, of course, you have Deuteronomy 34, with the report of the death of Moses. Now, I make this parenthetical note in that when I preach through Deuteronomy, which will be very soon, we may hop out to a minor prophet in the evening just to kind of break up the rhythm a little bit and to do something different. But we're probably going to cover maybe 10 chapters in one sermon.
Wow.
In one of the first sermons. And we're going to kind of hopscotch across Deuteronomy. And it's funny, I was talking with somebody in the church whose name shall remain nameless. We were reading Deuteronomy, and it's very repetitive. It repeats everything that we just saw in Numbers to a large extent. And I say, yeah, that's right, it does, because it's reminding the second generation of everything that's happened before. So it rehearses that history. And so, that's one of the reasons why we'll do that. But then we're going to slow down at certain points in the book of Deuteronomy, especially when we cover, say, Deuteronomy chapters 27 through 32, towards the end. That's where kind of like there's just a lot of material in there that will slow down to a snail's pace. But I haven't quite figured out how we're going to break up Deuteronomy, but we'll see. Any questions on Deuteronomy before we proceed to talk about the books that follow? Terrific. No questions on Deuteronomy. Okay. Now, when we move on, we go on to the next section, to what we said before were the former prophets. This is what the Hebrew Old Testament calls them, the former prophets, which covers Joshua to Kings. Joshua to Kings.
Are we leaving Deuteronomy?
Huh?
We're leaving Deuteronomy?
Yes, we're leaving Deuteronomy and the Pentateuch.
Okay.
Yes.
You may have covered this one, so we
can't. Oh, no problem. We can repeat it.
Mosaic authorship and how Deuteronomy ends, talking about
Moses' death. Yeah. Yeah. If I wrote a book, and then 300 years later, somebody went behind me and edited it, and perhaps added some other material that I had written elsewhere, I would still be the author. And so in that sense, the first five books of the Bible, I believe, are large in part written by and compiled by Moses. Okay? So that I say written by, because there are many parts of the first five books of the Bible that I think that Moses, penned himself. As to whether or not he specifically wrote them down, or he dictates to somebody else, or whatever, that's another story. And I also say compiled, because a lot of scholars believe that some of the earliest narratives of the Old Testament antedated Moses. So that it's quite possible that you have, say, the creation narratives and some of the genealogies that are either oracular, in other words, they're passed on by oral tradition, or that they're written down. Now, somebody might say, well, then that means Moses didn't write it. And I say, yeah, but that's no big deal, in that Luke, for example, writes and compiles his gospel based on interviews and based on other sources that were available. So Luke uses sources. Yeah, so does Paul. So just because somebody uses sources doesn't negate the person's authorship. So in that sense, I think that it's possible that Moses employs sources as he compiles and puts together the first five books. That being said, the first five books also exhibit somebody else's hand long after Moses' death. And I want to say that it's under divine inspiration. But, for example, I'm trying to remember some of these points, and I may not get them accurately, but there are certain times when there will be cities that are named in the patriarchal narratives, but the cities weren't called that in the day of the patriarchs. It was called that in the days of Israel's existence. So in other words, an editor has gone back and either changed or updated the name so that people knew what they were talking about. Or, for example, the famous statement, Moses, there was no one more humble than he in all the earth. That hardly seems like the statement that the most humble man would write about himself. And then, of course, say, for example, the account of Moses' death. So that there are certain places where it shows somebody's editorial pen under divine inspiration, but that still doesn't negate Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch, of the first five books of the Bible. And so in that regard, I always want to put the authorship of the Pentateuch in or around the Old Testament Exodus from Egypt, sometime around 14th, 15th century B.C. Liberal scholars want to put the Exodus, bump it up to, say, 12th, 11th century B.C. And then even further liberal scholars want to say, no, the Pentateuch never showed up in its complete and total form until the 6th or 5th century B.C. I want to back it up, say, 1,000 years and say that, yeah, it's large in part Moses who writes it. But see, here's like, for example, with the Genesis narratives, we always want to say, oh, this is historical narrative. And I always want to say, okay, yeah, but it's historical narrative with a huge asterisk. Because one of the characteristics of historical narrative is that it's an eyewitness account. You know, whether we're talking about the events of the Exodus or, you know, what have you, you've got an eyewitness who's recording these events under divine inspiration. What do you not have with the creation account? An eyewitness. And so in many respects, this is where I say that the first two chapters of Genesis, and even the first three chapters perhaps, but certainly the first two chapters, are very much like the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation unfolds and looks into the distant future, so to speak, as to what's to transpire in the future, of which we have no human witness. The book of Genesis 1 and 2 looks into the distant past, for which, again, we have no human witness, and tells us what happened. And, you know, if you want, you know, here's the extra 25-cent bonus, thrown in there, is that in many respects, I think Genesis 1 and 2, in terms of their structure, echo the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation is known as a progressive parallelism. We'll get into this, where the same story is told over and over again 7 times, but it moves forward and it tells it from a slightly different perspective. I think that's exactly what we have in Genesis 1 and 2, where you have the telling of the creation story 2 times, if perhaps not 3 times, in the sense of saying that you have the macro creation account with the creation of everything. You have the micro creation account with the account of the creation of man. And then you have the creation account from the perspective of the entrance of sin into the world. You know, where does sin come from and how did it get here? So if you look at that, in that respect, it's very similar structurally to what's going on in the book of Revelation at the end. Now, I'll withhold my speculations from there and think, well, gee, you got 3, you got 7, you got 10. Well, is that a connection? I don't know. The speculations could go on endlessly, but I'm certain to say that there's similar structural patterns certainly exist there between the beginning and the end. And as to where we got them, I don't know. It's a good question. Did Moses sit atop Sinai and the Lord said, get ready with your chisel? Tink, 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 tink. Okay, what was that? Can you slow down? Okay, tink, tink, tink. In the beginning, okay, got it. You know, or was this something that's oracularly passed down throughout generations so that around the Exodus generation, Moses, under the divine inspiration, collects it and records it? I don't know. Questions that I'm sure we'll have when we get to heaven. Go ahead.
Just tell me, go find the previous lecture.
No, that's fine. It's not a problem. It's good to review.
The whole thing about, you know, the secularistic scholars about the P and sources.
Yeah.
What do we make of that? Even striving.
Yeah. Okay. What about the liberal theories for the origin of the Bible? The origin of the first 5 books. Let me briefly explain that quickly. You have liberal scholars beginning in the early 19th century, late 18th century, early 19th century, who say that Moses is not the author of the first 5 books of the Bible, and that the first 5 books of the Bible originate in successive centuries from different authors or schools of authors, so that you have the J author. Let me put this down. The J author, and it's called J because he uses the name Yahweh, and it's called J with the Yahweh because that's how you spell Yahweh in German. This author is writing around the 9th century, no, 10th century B.C. You have the E author, who is known as the Eloist, and the Eloist uses the name Elohim. Okay? Anywhere you see the name Elohim, it comes from this source in the 9th century. Anywhere where you see the name Yahweh used, you have it roughly in the 10th century. And then you have the D author, which is the Deuteronomist, which is written in about the 8th century B.C. These are rough dates. For example, Book of Deuteronomy, those types of things are coming from the 8th century. And then you have the P author, which is known as the priestly author, And you have that written roughly, maybe 7th century, maybe 6th century B.C. So that the argument is that the Pentateuch is written over a span of some 500 years, rather than written in the span of, say, one generation, large in part by one author, Moses. So the question is where does this theory come from? Around the same time, you have, and this is one of the things I think that was like pouring gasoline on a fire in the 19th century, you have evolutionary thought in the sciences, say Darwin. That theory, evolutionary theory, and this is one of the things you see as far as sometimes, a lot of times, disciplines cross over and talk to one another and begin to influence one another. So evolutionary theory begins to grow in acceptance. And you have this theory for the origin of the Bible, and these two things mixed together, and I'm not sure the exact timing, but you have many Old Testament scholars who say Israel was originally a polytheistic culture. What's polytheism? Yeah, they worship many one gods, and that they eventually evolved into a monotheistic culture. What's monotheism? One God. So that by the time you get down here to the 6th, 7th, maybe 5th centuries, they're monotheistic. And so what you have here is you have your priestly author going back and putting this stuff all together so that it says, oh yeah, we believe this all along. Okay? And so in that sense, you have evolutionary theory as Israel's religion evolves into this idea, and it evolves over, say, about 500 years. The problem with this, I think, is that they really don't think that whoever might have edited this was very good at editing. Because they supposedly say, look at this, the first creation account is so contradictory to the second creation account. Genesis 1 is so contradictory to Genesis 2 because you have a different ordering of things in Genesis 1 and 2. In Genesis 2, you have man created first, then the animals. In Genesis 1, you have the animals created, and then you have man created. So they say, look at this. These are obviously from two totally different sources. And I always like to say, people aren't that big of an idiot. Maybe my subject-verb agreement there isn't right, so it's making me sound like an idiot. But people aren't that dumb. I want to say, you really think that some guy's going to read this and go, well, I see these big, you know, these big gaps here and these contradictions. And even though I'm putting this book together myself, I can't, you know, do a little bit of erasing and rearranging to make sure that this matches up perfectly. I want to say, these guys would have to be morons. Yeah, it's chronological arrogance. Everybody that's gone before us was a fool and an idiot. You know, they didn't know what they were doing. And I want to say, no, you know, these guys, you know, they were people just like us. And miracles were just as miraculous to them as they would be to us. And we say, well, they weren't very scientific. And you want to say, well, come on, give me a break. You've got, as scientific as we are, you still got baseball players, you know, who refuse to change socks because they don't want to change their lucky streak, carrying around rabbit's foot, whatever. Yeah, you get the idea. You know, they carry around trinkets. You can probably get some sort of scientific engineer to open up the horoscope. Okay, what's going to happen today? And then equally on the flip side of the coin, these guys, you know, you have algebra, you know, somebody help me here, that's developed by, you know, Arabian cultures around the 10th century B.C., if not even before. You know, as well as the Mayans and the Arabian cultures or the Middle Eastern cultures developing astronomy, those kinds of things. So they weren't bozos. They believed in luck as much as our own culture does this day today. And you know, don't get me started on, you know, global warming as a religion. You know, so that they're just as there were crazy religions in that day, there are crazy religions in our own day. The army just now approving Wiccan, you know, grave sites tomb markings. You know, so there's all kinds of crazy things. So we should never be that denigrating to previous generations. And at the same token, too, on the flip side of the coin, we want to say this, is that could it be possible that the Bible is telling us something on its own terms, not in the terms and the assumptions of 19th century evolutionary thought, not in the terms of 21st century scientific presumptions, but is the Bible telling us something in its own terms, according to its own patterns, and according to its own way? In that, is it possible that we have here two topical accounts of the creation, where it's not so concerned with strict chronology, but it wants to talk about things thematically? And I obviously opt for the latter. In Genesis 1 and 2, Genesis 1 and 2, chapter 1, you have the earth was without form and void. That's the thesis statement of Genesis 1. God begins to fill, give it form, and then he fills that form. He fills the void. Genesis 2 has a thesis statement. There was no tendable agriculture, something to that effect, and there was no man to till the ground. So what does he do? He creates the man to till the ground, and he plants the garden. And he answers that twofold question. So there are those statements. So I want to say, in the same way that you get the gospel writers to talk about the ministry of Jesus in topical terms, John is very topical in his gospel. It's chronologically out of sync with, say, the gospel of Mark or the gospel of Matthew. But just because we do a topical account of history doesn't therefore negate its historicity or its veracity. If I wanted to, and I used this illustration before, but if I wanted to talk about World War II history, and I wanted to do it talking about the major generals or the generals of World War II, and then in a second chapter I wanted to talk about the chronological sweep of the war. Oh, contradiction. These two accounts can't possibly be, harmonized. No, they can be.
Is it just me, or has our culture just swallowed that completely uncritically, and that's just a fact?
Yeah, I think so.
If your NPR took an interview with somebody, they're just going to, this guy's, we all know, JEP.
Yeah, I think so, because, have many people just uncritically swallowed it? And I think the answer is yes, I think they have. There are a lot of scholars who kind of chuckle at this now, and I'm not talking about just conservative scholars. They're liberal scholars who say, no. And in fact, there's even a turn now in liberal scholarship to say, you know what, let's not try to break this thing up like we did. Let's just look at it as a whole and see what kind of themes there are across the whole of the scriptures. Now, mind you, they're not coming to it with the same assumptions that we are, that it's the whole is inspired by God and that it's the inerrant, infallible word of God. But they're saying, well, let's look at it as a whole, as a finished product. And there's a lot of fruitful scholarship going on in that way in terms of looking at the Bible as a whole. So there are changes and trends. And once again, look at the scientific community. I'm not saying that the trends of influence always work this way, but in the 19th century, you have evolutionary theory influencing biblical scholarship. And I can't help but think that with a theory of relativity and those types of things, you have relativism that is influencing a lot of biblical and theological scholarship, and a lack of uncertainty and those types of things. I've heard the Heisenberg uncertainty principle quoted to me in terms of theological discourse. And you're just kind of like, oh my word, what are you kidding me? What's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? It's that, I'm not a scientist, but there are certain types of molecules, atoms, something like that, that you can't determine both the position and its speed at the same time. You can either determine its position or its speed. One of the two, but not both. And so, and so they say, notice the uncertainty there. Well, we can't be too certain or dogmatic about, things in Scripture. You're kind of like, are you kidding me? You're comparing kind of apples to oranges here. But anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. Any other questions about this mess or anything else? Anything, that's fine. Okay, let's continue on and let's talk about the former prophets. And I want to kind of do a very big, broad overview of the former prophets, okay? And then we'll kind of go into details, beginning again with the book of Joshua. In that, the prophets are largely made up of two parts. In that it goes, first of all, the prophets. Let me back up and say the prophets are made up of two parts, the former prophets and the latter prophets. Former prophets and the latter prophets. Former prophets cover Joshua to Kings. Latter prophets cover Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, and the Book of the Twelve. Book of the Twelve being, of course, the 12 minor prophets. All right. Now, the Book of the Twelve is largely compiled of anthologies of prophetic speeches. I'm sorry, I'd say this about the latter prophets as a whole. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, and the Book of the Twelve. They're anthologies of prophetic speeches that are largely delivered during the events of the latter half of the Book of Kings. Okay? The Book of Kings. So like 2 Kings. And the former prophets begin by recalling Moses' death and the importance of obedience to the law, obedience to the Torah. Okay, so notice there in the book of Joshua, we have the recollection of the death of Moses. Now, what does that do in terms of the antecedent biblical narrative? If the book of Joshua recalls the death of Moses, how is that tied now to what's gone before?
Because Moses dies.
Moses dies, and Moses is the big cheese for what big event? The Exodus. Exodus is given to us because of God's promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So in other words, notice how the book of Joshua in the narrative here is hooked up with everything that's gone before. Okay, so that you have to be familiar with that antecedent narrative. So in the book of Joshua, that first bookend connects us to everything that's gone before. But now as we swing out here to the end of the latter prophets, in other words, the end of the Old Testament, it ends with the book of Malachi. Okay, Malachi. Malachi chapter 4, verses 4 and following. Listen and tell me how this connects it with everything that's gone before. Remember the law of my servant Moses, the statutes and the rules that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and the hearts of the children to the fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction. Okay, how does that statement in Malachi 4, 4 through 6 connect us with what's gone before?
Talks about the law.
The law of Moses. So there it's connecting us with the first five books of the Bible. But then when it says there in Malachi 4, 6, what does this remind you of? We just talked about it this morning. And he, that is the Lord, will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers.
Circumcision of the heart.
Circumcision of the heart in what book? Deuteronomy. Okay, the book of Deuteronomy. And remember the theme that I talked about, where Israel as the rebellious son is cast into exile. And what does Malachi promise here about he says there, he's going to turn the hearts of the fathers to their children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. In many respects, this is evocative here of that Deuteronomy curse that God's saying, I'm going to turn my son Israel's attention and his focus and his devotion back to me. Back to me. So notice here how the end of the Old Testament, in terms of the latter prophets, is looking back here to these promises there in Deuteronomy. Now listen to this. This one is a really good one. In that the former prophets ends with the book of Kings, and the land is in chaos. And I want you to listen here. Listen to this as I read this. This comes now from the prophet Jeremiah. And I'm going to ask you, what does this remind you of? Jeremiah 4:23 and following. And I looked on the earth, and behold, it was without form and void. Yeah, warning bell should be going off when we hear that language. That's Genesis 1:2. Notice where we are. Israel's about ready to get cast off into exile. There's chaos in the land. There's sin everywhere. And in fact, if memory serves me correctly, you have the northern kingdom, I think, if I remember correctly, that's already been hauled off into exile. So in this respect, notice how the Old Testament itself is characterizing the Old Testament narrative in terms of the original Genesis 1 through 3 narrative. Everything's without form and it's without void. So that in this respect, we can say that when God brings Israel out of exile, and he does so ultimately through Jesus, it's an act of new creation. If he's taking the form and void of Israel And he's restoring, and he's removing that form and void. He's removing that that chaos that was over the land, and he's putting order. And especially when you connect it with it's these sinful kings, not Beth and Wally, these sinful kings that have done this. Okay, sorry, cheap shot. These sinful kings that have done this. Who now is the faithful king that is going to eliminate the without form and the void condition of Israel as God's people? It's Jesus, the faithful king. Okay? And so in this sense, you know, notice here basically what we would say at this point is that it seems as though the promises of God are all but dead. Israel, the firstborn son of God, has been disobedient and lies in an exilic graveyard. But even then, in this exilic graveyard, what do we have the promise of through one of the prophets? Israel's in the exilic graveyard. It's just a pile. It's just a valley of bones. And God says, I'm going to send forth my breath, my spirit, and I'm going to cause these bones to rise. I'm going to put flesh on these bones, and I'm going to make them live because I'm going to put my spirit within them. Okay? So that, for example, when Paul says in Galatians 3:14, that Christ suffered the curse of the law so that the Gentiles might receive the promised Spirit, Paul has in mind, I think Ezekiel 36, Joel 2:28, Isaiah chapter 40, and passages like that. So that hopefully you're beginning to see how a lot of these seemingly disparate events and the seemingly rag bag of stories it connects all up together. let me see here. I think I got enough time here to cover the book of Joshua. So let's talk about the book of Joshua relatively quickly. The narrative center of the book of Joshua comes at the assembly of the tabernacle, Joshua 18:1. And the whole congregation of the people of Israel assembled at Shiloh and set up the tent of meeting there. The land laid subdued before them. What does that bring up? Subdued. Creation narrative. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Okay, but here we note, of course, in the conquest, they say here that they subdue the land. But let me ask you this. Was it Israel in her might that subdued the land? No, it's marching around Jericho and the like. So it was the Lord who gave them the victory. So here we have this little picture at this stage in the narrative. Israel, God's son, is exercising dominion over the land, and God dwells in their midst. What is that reminiscent of? Garden of Eden. Other elements that point back to the first five books of the Bible. Joshua slays the Canaanite kings and hangs them from trees. What's that? Remember? Yeah, curse of the covenant, Deuteronomy chapter 21. Anyone who is hung from a tree is under God's curse, so that we can say in this respect that as the Canaanites are driven out of the land, this is the outworking of the curse upon the seed of the serpent. And putting these men up on trees is indicative of covenant curse. We can also say that the curse of Ham, okay, is working out itself. It's working itself out on his sons and descendants. Because remember, Noah curses Ham for what act? Uncovering his nakedness. And who was Ham's son? Canaan. Canaan is the father of whom? Canaanites. And now the Canaanites are being driven out of the land. So notice here how in Joshua, you got to go all the way back to Genesis chapter 9 to see how all of these events are connected and they're working out according to the promises that God has given. Okay? So that quite literally, any time, there are three things that you have to do when you look at any passage of Scripture. You want to figure out what's going on at the present. You want to ask, how is it connected with what's gone before? And in what way is it pointing forward to what's to come? Okay? Except now, in the end of the book of Joshua, Joshua closes out the book with two speeches, as it's been customary for a dying patriarch, say in Genesis 49 or Moses' speech in Deuteronomy 32 and 33. And if his first speech focuses on the initial success of the conquest, okay, but it says that completion of the conquest can only come if they keep the Torah. And then just as Moses did, Joshua concludes his speech by warning against apostasy and exile. Okay? And then what he also does in his second speech is he rehearses God's mighty acts and calls Israel to a renewed fulfillment. And then the people respond with an affirmative answer, but Joshua gives a cynical response, which essentially serves as a blueprint for the next 500 years. Joshua 24:19. But Joshua said to the people, "You are not able to serve the Lord, for He is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions and sins." In other words, you said you're going to be obedient, but I know you're not. And he says that under divine inspiration. In other words, you're going to be thrown into exile. And if this statement essentially fits in with the same other types of statements, those at Sinai, those at the departure from Sinai, Moses' farewell speech, as well as in Deuteronomy, Israel lacks the heart, ultimately, to keep the Torah. And this is because God is still pointing forward, at this point in the narrative, to the one person who does have the heart, if you will, to keep the Torah. And it's, of course, pointing to Jesus. Now, we've got a few minutes here before the bottom of the hour. And we'll pick up next week with Judges. And, you know, what we're going to do is we're kind of moving now more quickly through the Old Testament here. But any questions? Yes, Tom.
Well, I'll just comment, if you don't mind.
No, that's fine.
It's very fascinating. It's very encouraging, you know, seeing these themes tied together. It's great.
Yeah.
I was going to comment about the idea that there's different authors. One piece of this could be so stupid to paste it together in some way. What I thought of was, well, this is the time before paper and pencils, let alone computers. How could someone have, you know, now that I see it where you're explaining to them, how could a priestly group, or how could anybody go back and put it together in such a complex way?
Yeah, exactly. How could they? I mean, you think about it. Nowadays, it's as simple as cut, paste, drag, and drop. Right? Whereas back then, you'd have to like recopy an entire scroll. Just think of some guy, and human beings being what they are, if you know, 9th century Israelites or anything like my 21st century seminary students, you know, they'd be like, "I got to recopy the whole book of Isaiah? Are you kidding me? You know, there's like 66 chapters in that book, all so that I can change this to make it fit with that? What are you crazy? No way! I don't have the time. You know how many candles I'm going to use doing that? You know, so yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And when you begin to consider that they've put this out and that this book, the Old Testament, is put together, say, over, you know, almost some 2,000 years at least, and this consistency of this message, the diversity of authors, kings, farmers, shepherds, politicians, poor people, women. You put all of these different groups of people together, and they're all consistently over 2,000 years saying the same message, and so consistently looking back. It's an amazing book. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's see. Let's go with Wally, Kevin, and then Gina. So a little L shift there.
Two quick comments.
Yes.
One, you know, if this whole idea was valid, not only would it, you know, require a whole lot of effort to recopy all these books, but then they'd have to make sure that the copy that they were correcting was destroyed, and that there were no other copies around
yeah.
to, you know, confuse people.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, this theory of the multiple authorship of the Pentateuch sort of reminds me, you know, of, you know, the scientific theory of evolution as well.
Mm-hmm.
In the popular mind, this, just like evolution, is still presented as if, well, the, you know, everybody knows that this is true.
Right.
So like on, you know, NPR, that they have some so-called news story about this. I mean, this is just presented, well, everyone accepts this. Whereas, you know, in the scientific community, there are a lot of people admit there are a lot of serious issues with,
yeah.
even among atheistic scientists, you know, there's a lot of problems with Darwinian
yeah.
theory. And just, you know, and liberal scholars would say the same thing about this. You know, we don't really subscribe to this theory anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But among certain groups, it's still presented as if,
yeah,
well, yeah, if you don't believe this, you're
yeah.
stupid.
Yeah, like, this is the basic theory. Well, there are a lot of scholars, for example, who say, well, there's J1, J2, J3, 4, and 5. There's D1 through 8, because they think they've identified even further, you know, sources and all that kind of business. And so it's, you know, I've heard scholars who have absolutely no interest in, you know, kind of conservatism whatsoever say, this is, you know, this is ancient, this is old, you know, this is a silly theory, you know, and they just have, but like you say, yeah, in certain quarters, this is just presented as fact. And it's kind of like, pull your head out of the sand and take a look around. There are other scholars talking about this in a different way. Yeah, Kevin.
It shows the importance of, you know, a Christian being educated, of learning the Bible. You see something like this, you see why it's set back a lot of fundamentalists mm-hmm. who go off to, you know, the bachelor's, master's in religion, with
yeah.
faith, because they thought that the Bible dropped out of the sky.
Yeah.
Basically, they got an idea of the Bible like the Quran.
Yeah.
You know, and then you hear they just point something out, like, you know, Moses, you know, somebody, you know, Moses was a homeless man. Point out, obviously Moses wasn't the author, and they've got nothing to do with this. They're just living in faith.
Yeah.
When in actuality, it can be a great argument for the scripture, because
yeah.
you know, the Quran, for example, yeah. they did do that. You know, the guy said, "We're going to destroy all the other ones." He brought them all in,
yeah.
and then he destroyed the rest. But this is like it's called the incarnational analogy for scripture.
Yeah.
That, just as God came into reality
mm-hmm.
in the incarnation, he did the same with his word.
Yeah.
He used the messiness
yeah.
of history,
yeah.
and still there's this consistent theme.
Yeah.
You know, even these unbelievers will talk about why all these barren women. You know,
yeah.
what does that have to do with it? It's really about some kind of power play.
Yeah.
You know, about different political groups. Well, why all these barren women?
I think that a simple, careful reading of the Old Testament, and you could teach this to your children, that you constantly show them these code words, subdue, be fruitful, multiply, form and void, those kinds of things. You show them those kind of key words so that when they hear them in the story, they're like, all of a sudden the lights go on and they think. That's a simple way to equip your children so that they're sitting in class. I guarantee you they know the flow of the narrative like this. They'll know the narrative better than an Old Testament professor in many liberal institutions or many religion teachers. They'll be able to say, well, if that's the case, then how do you account for the consistency of boop, 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 and they name all of these things, and then the professor, I guarantee, will be sputtering. Because they're like, well, let me get back to you. I promise.
That's not happening.
Yeah, and I think the large in part is two reasons. One, we're lazy. We don't know our Bibles. But then two, the broader trend in the church is to just look at the New Testament, and then even then, so look at it in terms of, you know, just fortune cookie, you know, just give me my scripture verse for the day. And that's one of the reasons why my students say, well, how do you teach people this? And I say, well, you have to be committed to a long-term strategy. And that's why we're, you know, going through the Old Testament, you know, and I'm preaching through it. And I say, yeah, I'm almost done. I'm so excited. I'm all fired up because I'm almost done with the Pentateuch, which is so foundational. I'm trying to set you know, the foundation there so that we're prepared to move on out. So that if anybody sticks around for 20 years, you know, God willing, they're going to see the whole Bible unfolded before them. And I said, that's something that requires patience and time and effort. But, you know, if we do that, you know, for a generation or two, can equip the church in that way to know its Bible. Yeah, Gina.
I just had a quick comment.
Okay.
On what you were talking about, without form and void, harkening back to creation and how Christ was the fulfillment of that.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me of Colossians 1:16, where by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, all that. Just basically that he's the author of the first creation.
Yep.
Also.
Yep.
And
yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, you definitely, anytime you're talking about creation, this is the other problem, I think, with a lot of Christians, is they want to look at Genesis in terms of science, when Paul never looks at it in terms of science. He looks at creation in terms of Christ, and that the Old Testament is telling the same story in shadow form of what Christ will do in the future in his own ministry. Shameless book club. Get my book, and you'll see how I talk about that. That's Last Things First, $12.24, available at the Westminster Bookstore, WTSbooks.com. All right, aside from that, let's...